Hello, and welcome to another episode of Into the Fold. This is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health. We are a mental health grant-making foundation, part of the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more about who we are and what it is that we're up to, as well as our numerous grant programs, you can visit www.hogg.utexas.edu. As always, any and all feedback is welcome. Let us know what you think. Email us at hogg.com at austin.utexas.edu. Today, we're going to be talking about what it means to self-disclose as a person with lived experience of mental illness, particularly within workplace or professional settings. Not just the disclosure part, but also the self part. Different selves come from different places, and that affects the what, where, how, and when of their disclosure. Our guest today is Mr. Willie Williams, a contract administrator at the City of Austin Health and Human Services Department, also a co-coordinator of the Austin Area African American Behavioral Health Network, a professional network of African American behavioral health professionals that meets regularly here at the Hogg Foundation. Willie, how's it going?
It's a pleasure to be invited to share some thoughts and ideas with you, and in hopes that as a result, someone else will take that next step in recovery for them.
Yeah. So before I get into the questions that I've already shown you, I was hoping that maybe you could give us a bit of an overview of just your life, your background, and your experience, and maybe hit just a few of the high points along your way to where it is that you are now, if you don't mind.
It's been a very joyful experience. My home is in Austin, Texas. I grew up in Austin in the 40s when there were more people on 6th Street today on a Saturday night than there were in the entire city of Austin. I was fortunate enough to attend Catholic school from kindergarten through high school. Matter of fact, St. Edward's University previously had a college prep from the 7th to the 12th grade where I attended. And I did my undergraduate work majoring in sociology in Kansas. And from there, really had a great opportunity to work for a Fortune 500 company. It happens to be Kellogg's of Battle Creek, and later was learned that I was the first Afro-American to be hired by that industry west of the Mississippi. That's only important in terms of the generation. You were expected to succeed. You had to have the unblemished record. You were raised with the attitude education, very valuable, and again, a clean record, whether that be in terms of in your lifestyle, needed to be at the highest level. From that point, after being with Kellogg's, understanding the glass ceiling that many Afro-Americans faced at that time, did my work in secondary ed at UC Berkeley, and then continued some educational opportunities with a master's in social psychology and background in economics and Robert A.F. Taft Fellow and Poli Sci Malibu and so forth. But career-wise, and as it comes back to the conversation we're having today, in approximately 53, 54, I watched a man who the community knew had a mental illness, and we just called him Mr. Charlie. And he was obviously intoxicated, walking across the street, 11th Street here in Austin. Almost got hit by a car, but then saw a police car behind the original car, and the policeman got out and I would say beat him mercifully because of his actions, they almost hit another car. And that was kind of the first time I really took a hard look at why is this? The community always made sure that he was taken care of. Later, having gone to work at Kellogg's at the age of 20, shortly after that, a family member, I was asked to, hey, she's having some what we think mental health issues. There are more opportunities in Northern California. Would you agree to have her come live with you and maybe see if there was some professional assistance? And through that involvement, I became involved with one of the five or six mental health alliances. And later in 1980 or so, they came together to form what we now know as NAMI, the National Alliance of Mentally Ill. So I was just always involved in from that perspective, as well as being one of the first three or four educators to accept individuals with disabilities into mainstreaming, and that was something that was going on in the early 70s in the California area, as opposed to sending them off to separate schools. And that's kind of always been my involvement on a number of just everyday doing things. The whole idea of mental illness, you know, you had people that had sugar or high blood, if they were, and those were just terms that you grew up with through oral history, and that's the way individuals self-identified or family members identified other individuals' blood relatively or not within that family circle. And somewhere in high school, I'd wake up and boom, there was just a nickel-sized, quarter-sized ball spot. And fortunately, my dad was a businessman, mother a teacher. Were able to get some assistance, and we put shots, and there never was a name, and it's kind of, you know, referred to now as alopecia. But, you know, like, why? It didn't run in the family, et cetera. In subsequent years, hey, that's a lot of that anxiety and stress that was then identified. In professionally in the early 80s, you know, after doing a number of things, whether it be part of the first group that put the initial or calls to be put in place the initial safety net under the Golden Gate Bridge back in the 70s, the San Francisco Bay Area Suicide Prevention Group. And so I was involved in those type of things. But in the early 80s, I became the assistant director of an adolescent treatment facility. These youngsters were adjudicated from across the state of California. Worked very closely with the competent psychiatrists and other staff members for these high-need individuals. And again, I'm, you know, back into that field of using some of my expertise and working with individuals. At the same time, it was a time where the state of California, under the governorship of Ronald Reagan, kind of, they say, emptied out the mental health institutions and did a lot of consulting work in placing these individuals in community settings. That gave me additional information and exposure to that. My personal battle that was, I first kind of realized, actually occurred in about 83. Although I, with Kellogg's, I was in public relations, space management. My job was to entertain. It was during a time when the business of America in the mid-late 60s was, the business of America was business. So they would fly out in and everyone to San Francisco, their family, their in, or as individuals, and you entertain the finest restaurants, the symphony, light opera, and that was great for a youngster with a liberal arts education. But one of the keys was that, one, I didn't drink. Two, my responsibility was make sure that that person was not hurt. So you had a lot of orange juice made up to look like screwdrivers, I guess. And the whole smoking of illegal drugs at that time in the state of California, if you were arrested for possession of any drugs, you would lose your teaching credentials. And I stayed away from it all because my mother would have killed me knowing that I went to school, did all of this. She was a teacher and had me lose a license. So I kind of skated through that whole era of not being tempted or involved in alcohol use or illegal substance use. Back to the early 80s, to 83, and again, in retrospect, I guess when I pinned, hey, I'm drinking beer. I never liked beer. And that went on, and through the grace of God, no problems, no job loss, none of those horror stories. And I think the thing that I would like to remember out of that is just coming back from a social club, community social club, civic club meeting, and the next thing I knew, I was just asking my wife, please call Austin Recovery, ask for so-and-so, because I had worked with these individuals over the years as an administrator at TSD, et cetera, et cetera. I need help. And did the 28-day program, followed their good direction, and kind of never looked back. Again, in retrospect, it only, for me, goes to say that one does not, the bottom for each individual is different. So it doesn't mean you have to go to jail. It doesn't mean you have to go to the state hospital. It just may be the sermon that you hear in church one day or whatever. And that's across the board. Professionally, it was like, okay, I need to send these letters, et cetera, to the various licensure boards. I hold licensures from the Texas Medical Board as well as the Texas Department of Health and Human Services to take care of that in the at that time, and that worked out well. And then along with somewhere out of that came the diagnosis of anxiety. And I don't know, on medication for a couple years and weaned myself off of that. And life just went on. Life was life. From the position strictly of a black professional working in as dean of students, working in the caregiving, counseling, case management role. I've done a lot of work in child abuse, HIV, AIDS, children's mental health, IDD. My training in the early, mid-60s was, hey, you are there for the client, not to share the client your story and how you did. It's not a 12-step program or opportunity to have a conversation. So that was kept, you just didn't talk about it. But I was also during that time period in the educational process that every clinician should have their own counselor, social worker, whoever they could go to and dump. Long story short, I'm not sure I needed that, but I think that kind of prompted the way I dealt with not disclosing not disclose, you're going to roll ahead. It may give you greater empathy, but your sole purpose was to help that person make a decision of what was the next best thing for them. I don't know where to kind of go from there, but I mean, that was the, like I said, coming out, and even today, you know, I understand. People, you interacted with people during those years and since, and probably there's nothing that I've done that I thought was a secret that someone doesn't know, and I'm kind of too old to care about it, and it didn't, I didn't get arrested, and fortunately, I didn't hurt anyone. So, and I said hurt anyone, I mean, not necessarily emotionally, but you know, I didn't lose family and job and kids. I haven't, we had children. So all of those kinds of things didn't happen. And maybe that made it a little bit easier to not have to worry about disclosure.
Okay, so so what I'm hearing you say is that rather than there being a single decisive coming out moment, that in your case, it just sort of happened. And
yeah, I think it sort of happened. And I think the people around me, because of my experiences, my responsibilities, especially at, for example, Austin Travis County Integral Care, previously MHMR, people that I worked with, that I was working, assisting, counseling, or whatever, I think since that I'd been there. And I say this often, I could never play poker because everything that I, is all on my face. And so as you're working with the individual doing active listening, your mouth may be shut, but the person that you're talking to kind of has a sense of that person really gets what I'm saying. And so I think it's been out there. I've always been a very, very advocate for consumer involvement. Nothing, before it became the kind of phrase, nothing for us without us, people first language. As a matter of fact, the Central Texas Afro-American Family Support Conference, which I'm often given credit for, but it's a community thing initiated, was focused on consumers to the point that it was convincing individuals at the Hall Foundation that were involved and other organizations. The first year, it was not going to happen under my leadership unless we had consumers coming in and directing what the conference would be, what the speakers would be like, et cetera. Because everyone around the table was accustomed to putting on conferences, but not a consumer conference. And that's all based on some of the work done by the South Texas Family Support Conference, which is primarily aimed at those who are Spanish speaking. So I think that through my actions, through my advocacy, somebody said, hey, okay, yeah, he says he's a family member, but this probably goes further than that. There's a greater involvement, a greater attachment.
Now, I know it's probably not easy to speak on behalf of hypothetical people that you haven't met, but in your own opinion, do people overestimate the difficulties that they'll encounter by self-disclosing, or are we still at a place where, you know, you can understand people still erring on the side of caution?
I think a lot of it depends upon the, and professionally, for example, on their age and the generation. Those who were raised where social media is common, they're realizing they're not isolated. If we go back 20 years or so, and we saw in the late 80s and early 90s, and I'll speak in general, an influx of individuals who were gay, lesbian, bi, or transsexual, queer to the Austin area because they'd come from small towns, and here there was some safety in numbers. Today, there are, through social media, hotlines. So if I'm living in X town, Texas, with a half a dozen people that are all belong to ex-church, I have a way to communicate and express myself, et cetera. So that I think the time of your being raised has a lot to do with that. And then times have changed. Cultural diversity hopefully has moved past that thing of where we're talking about, well, is he black, Latino, or white, and realizing we have such blended generations, we've moved past that into linguistic cosmos. We talked about kind of, we look at a lot of the stuff that came out of Satcher's work in 2000 and 2001. And so I think it's just hypothetically, it's different. I think it's easier. There are more protection within certain organizations, and I'm involved on a department-wide, to making sure that even in the Health and Human Services bulletins and announcements hey, how is that depicted? Are we just saying husband and wife? We're becoming much more sensitive to the diversity of our workforce as well as the diversity of our overall population. Thus, we celebrate a individual who she and her partner have just adopted, say, one or two children or something to that effect.
So by now, I mean, you've had the chance to have this kind of conversation with an awful lot of people, I would think. What kinds of reactions from colleagues, even from those who wish you well, have been maybe perhaps the least helpful among when you tell them these sorts of things about yourself, or the most helpful?
Well, even today, I will, if it's appropriate, says I'm a consumer and family member, or I'm a family member. I, even just today, don't start recounting my history and how I live in recovery. I feel good about myself. I tell you what I do today to age productively. But I don't spend time talking about any of the challenges that were there prior to DSMs in the mid-70s. I don't. So as a result, if they know, they know, and it's not a topic of discussion. And
so going off script just a little bit, because when you were telling me about, in particular, the African American community, and let me just say to our listeners that that I am black, even though it doesn't always come off, and that our way of talking about mental illness, particularly if you go back to, let's just call it a prior time, versus we can call it the new way of talking about mental illness. And do you have any deep thoughts on whether there's any kind of a common ground that can be found between, let's say you're trying to explain the latest thinking in mental illness, to an African American who's age 70 or older. That may even be a conversation that you've had the opportunity to have. How challenging can that be? And, or how much of a pleasure can it be when, you have that light of understanding that goes on?
Well, I think one of the first things in your statement that I thought about was that, you have to be able to afford to have a mental illness. Okay, you're trying to maybe get the free booster shot, the TB shot, or whatever they're giving at the public clinic, and going to see a psychologist or counselor. That's kind of not in the budget. But in speaking with individuals, and that's one of my assigned content areas of aging, the seniors in our community, and the big picture planning around that area, along with a couple of others. But the first thing that comes out, I'm not crazy. And there's not a separation about they're schizophrenic. You know, they got those two personalities, or I'm not crazy. And especially as we see some of our individuals as they age begin to experience various degrees of dementia. And being a caregiver for two now and previously others, one in their 90s, living alone, but very coherent at one point in the day, and because of the frustration of not being able to do the things the way she used to do them, because, you know, no longer do bank statements come with the reprint of your check. They come with little codes. And as one starts talking, and then the first thing I hear, I'm not crazy. And the other thing when referring to someone else, well, you know they were schizophrenic. Their mother, their so-and-so, whatever, died at that state hospital. And I know that because I used to go out there and take gifts. There are some individuals that you can begin to discuss health and wellness and put that in the context of integrated health. That's what a professional would talk about. But, we're worried about your diabetes. We know that you're getting really frustrated about that and your cholesterol. And you're also really getting stressed out because at your age, you're wondering, what are you going to do with that grandson or granddaughter that you are now responsible for, have no idea what this computer thing is, and stress, and showing them and discussing with them that total body of health. That I find, and others that have more active involvement with the community, find that a relatively successful approach. But again, as it gets down to that individual, no, I'm not crazy. I'm different. And that's been my experience. And based on a lot of input from working with, concentration of working with seniors, not only locally, but across the country, and what's happening in that area, in that field.
Now, you know, sometimes I do casually mention that I've suffered from depression and anxiety, but I don't professionally self-identify as a consumer. I mean, at least not yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, it's not something that I've had much time to seriously consider. But even for those who think that they're already doing well enough, I mean, what in your opinion might be some of the added benefit to being more assertive about their lived experience?
Again, it's from my perspective. Remember, you're looking at someone who's getting close to 70. Even our meetings that are for the Afro-American Family Support Conference, the Consumer and Family event, if I mention it, I mention it casually, but only if it's going to help move someone to something, if it's going to help establish a relationship. If I already have a relationship, adding on that I'm a consumer doesn't take the relationship any further. It does not. It's not going to help me work with you in a more effective manner. And it is not my personal kind of goal to be the champion for those in recovery. I am a champion for mental and physical wellness. I am a champion for helping our professional have that change in paradigm that of recovery-oriented systems on a professional level that, you know, you are not going to be the case manager or case worker for three generations of a family. So I'm a very strong voice for that. But in order to be an advocate for that, I have not found it necessary to say, and by the way, I'm a consumer.
I guess what you're saying is that, you know, a person shouldn't necessarily feel pressured to self-disclose just to be a part of a bandwagon, but only if it seems obvious to them how it might serve.
For me, and I think for a number of individuals that came through that generation of training or whatever, is it only furthers. You and I are having a conversation, and we're talking about our experiences in sports. To talk to you about my experiences playing the musical instrument probably is not going to further that discussion about sports. So I'd say, share with people as you're building relationships or have things that will help grow and show commonality versus things that would make you different.
Okay. So rather than letting individual employees fend for themselves, which is kind of what people almost necessarily had to do, once upon a time. Mm-hmm. Do you have any advice for organizations, employers, on things they can be doing to either set an example or to make the whole thing less of an ordeal?
Yes, I do. And I have had the opportunity, as a matter of fact, over the last probably 18 months, working with one of your colleagues, Vicki Coffey, to do retreats for one or two departments for the city of Austin, which is made up of like 28 or 29 corporations, as it might be, as well as for another group, and encouraging those in supervisory roles to be mindful of three things. In fact, one, more of their staff, female staff, are veterans. And just kind of general, if men, we think of veterans as men now fighting. So that you have female staff that are returning to the workplace that have had some of the same experiences, may have some of the same emotional challenges that any other soldier has. So that's number one. So to be aware of that. Number two, many organizations have EAP, Employment Assistance Programs. And traditionally, you hear about it at the beginning of the year, and they give you a phone number, and that's the end of that discussion. And this is third, and it connects, I hope. A supervisor is saying, okay, I don't want to get so much into your business because I need to make sure I document what I said, file a company policy, et cetera, et cetera. And what I and others do is say, hey, without breaking policy, procedure, protocol, to sit down with that person and don't give them a phone. Talk, you learn yourself about the EAP program. Hey, you know that I understand that, you know, it's kind of general knowledge that your ex-wife and your stepson or whatever, EAP will cover that. And so you encourage them, you support them in moving and using the EAP program versus just, well, call EAP. And sometimes that hand-holding does not violate any privileges. It does not violate any policies and procedures, but it does open up an opportunity for that employee to do some sharing and some possibilities of, well, God, would that help you if I change your work hour from starting from 8 to 8:30. I have the ability to do that. So it enables you sometimes to help them within the company rules and regulations. So those are some of the things that I think can often, that we should explore more, and we should encourage supervisors to do more of.
You're a pretty busy guy, and you also happen to be, you know, an African-American man who's lived in the city of Austin for a long time. I tend to associate both of those with stress, but maybe that's just my own biases talking. So I can't help but be curious about, you know, what it is that you do that, you know, that helps you stay well on a day-to-day basis.
Maybe I've come accustomed to the stress. I will add one to that is I'm also, I guess, interracial marriage, whatever the proper term is, married to a white lady, as in my Caucasian lady, as it might be. And so in the city of Austin proper, walking around, et cetera, that's nothing unusual. But I still, for the most part, operate in an environment, a professional environment, where two things occur. The overt racist stuff doesn't tend to occur, although I get called the N-word for some reason from somebody, you know, once or twice a year, never paid attention. I happen to live in a community where I feel safe, but anytime I see a police officer just randomly pull over people, I immediately put my hands on the steering wheel, and the things that I learned as survival tools when we had a much segregated community fall in. How that affects in terms of just daily stress, I don't really think about it very much personally. Maybe it's because of my previous involvement with law enforcement, which does not prevent me from being the unwilling victim of some of the things that we see occur. Law Enforcement Advisory Committee and consulting for police departments, et cetera, but I'm very much aware that on any given day, if I run across a police officer, I need to go back to the basics of, no, not who I am or what. I have my hands on the steering wheel. What do you want me to do, sir? And I experienced that. I've had those experiences growing up that have reinforced it. Driving in my three-piece suit, had flown into Dallas, drove from Dallas to a little place called Hillsboro, run car back from Dallas to Oklahoma City to catch the 5:30 flight back to California. Speed limit in Oklahoma at those days was 50, and out of the gully kind of comes, and nobody else is on the highway, a highway patrolman. I'm maybe 40 miles from Oklahoma City, I'm guessing. He comes out, gun, tells me I'm speeding. I have my hands up, and I get the kind of comment, boy, what you doing all dressed up in this car? Get out of the car. I wasn't about to tell him I was college educated, made probably more money. I got out, and then I got real scared when he says, come back and sit in my car. And he shows me on the radar screen how fast I was going. And I saw what the radar screen, I was going about 5-6 miles under the speed limit. I kept my mouth shut. So those kinds of things, even today, if I get pulled over, I'm very happy. I will revert back to those lessons. Police officer pulls you over. You're right, you're wrong, you have a PhD. The prudent thing to do is to follow the officer's command and then discuss it in a safer environment. Whether it should, shouldn't be that way, there's a time and place for every discussion.
I could not let you go without asking at least one really trite philosophical question. It is a cliche that we're all works in progress. I hear people saying that quite a bit nowadays. And on a serious tip, I mean, is there anything about yourself or your place in the world that you're still trying to make sense of in 2014? Or do you think at this point you pretty much know what it is that you need to?
I went through that kind of thing back in, somewhere in the late 70s somewhere. Today, the only thing I'm working on is preparing myself for my new job or retirement whenever that comes. And I spent the time in discernment, and I'm not in charge. And I am very comfortable with the important things of my life, blessed with friends, blessed with real positive relationships with individuals, blessed in health, blessed in spiritual connection. And I don't know if that answers, but I've not trying to figure out what I should or should not be doing, and probably stopped trying to figure that out, again, in the late 70s. And because up until that time, a lot of what I did, whether it was run political campaigns, was I was often the first and definitely the only Afro-American that was making what I did open up doors for others to follow. As my parents and some of the people here that we still respect, and my mother being one of them, and the families that you often hear are the Means, the Kings, and we all grew up together, and they made it possible for a number of the things to happen for my generation. And so often forgotten, but I kind of finished playing that role as it might be in somewhere in the late 70s, and I've been okay with myself, I guess, even in going through the challenges of behavioral health challenges and recovery, and yeah.
I think that that's about all we need, and we very much appreciate the earful, and gosh, I look forward to seeing you around the office again.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity and the hope that something that I said I shared will be the word, the comment, the suggestion that will help someone else move on, and whether it's helping a family member or just their understanding, but it's beneficial, and how it's beneficial will be up to that individual receiving the message.
Willie Williams, thanks so much for being with us. Take care. So before we close, a couple news items I would like to share. Within the past few weeks, the foundation has awarded grants for the Transition Age Youth and Families grant program, as well as the Ima Hogg scholarships. For more information about these and other grants, you can visit www.hogg.utexas.edu. That is it for this episode of Into the Fold. Please like us on Facebook and check us out on Twitter @HogFoundation. Thanks for joining us.